Please welcome Heath LaRue to the stage. Heath is CEO of Sakalicha, business rights group that fights state overreach in court and wins. This year alone, Sakalicha feed back BEE conditions on international airlines, forced the state to freeze the NHI rollout, and won interim relief for farmers blocked from vaccinating their herds. His philosophy: safe-proof your business, don't wait on government. Welcome, Pete.
This BizNews production is brought to you by Brenthurst Wealth, the leader in offshore investing, connecting South Africa to opportunities worldwide. Invest better with Brenthurst.
Ladies and gentlemen, in South Africa, optimism is obligatory. I would soften it by saying it's almost obligatory, but it's actually obligatory. We like to take comfort in Jan Smuts's observation that in South Africa, neither the best nor the worst ever happens. The word sustain us beyond formidable obstacles, and it makes astounding decay and even lethargy bearable. Smuts was right, but not because the words describe something unique about South Africa. The adage holds for every country and every community always, until it doesn't. Optimism, and even Smuts hedged his optimism, is not a strategy. A strategy diagnoses a trajectory. It identifies a credible mechanism for interrupting that trajectory, and it makes that mechanism actionable. South Africa is plainly not on the right trajectory. It is deindustrializing, and it is consuming capital across cities, towns, and common infrastructure. The state celebrates dependence upon transfers, taxes a record small section of the population at record high levels, and hasn't seen employment and per capita growth in 20 years. Race-restrictive and redistributive legislation threatens the eventual displacement of Western subgroups and other racial minorities. And despite generally friendly relations between individuals, intergroup preferences remain decisive in politics at every level. It remains decisive. We are not gathered in the Drakensberg because this trajectory has not yet been sufficiently interrupted. Well, that's why we are gathered here. We are here because we are searching for better ways to interrupt it. The most advanced interruption of South Africa's trajectory today is domestic state-proofing. State-proofing begins when we no longer locate our theory of order, security, and constructive change solely in the state. To be state-proof is to be insulated from and increasingly able to resist the consequences of state failure and malicious state action. Relying only on the state for order and reform is the political equivalent of owning only one stock in your portfolio. When it fails, you are ruined. And at the March BizNews conference, Ceremonis, I described how individuals, businesses, and civil institutions are learning to carry order and cooperation independently of the state. That process in South Africa is young, but it is already laying the foundations for a better society under any election scenario. Today, I extend that argument outward. Can an external actor interrupt South Africa's trajectory for the better? The primary candidate for that is the United States. My argument is that South Africa is already being reconstituted, and that American policy has an opportunity to account for the actual distribution of power, away from treating Pretoria as the whole of South Africa, and towards constructive differentiation among its centers of competence, authority, and influence. The United States has twice played an important role in South Africa's political imagination. It inspired aspects of foundational South African statecraft. Pretoria itself was, at its founding 175 years ago, first known as Pretoria, Philadelphia. That was the original name, Pretoria, Philadelphia, after the birthplace of the American Declaration of Independence. More recently, the United States helped to interrupt South Africa's apartheid trajectory, encouraged by the ANC and many others across the world. Today, America has again signaled concern about where South Africa is heading. To understand what it may do and whether its actions may be harmful or helpful, it can be both, can be either. We should begin not with what people in South Africa might wish America would do, but with American interests. The first American interest is South Africa as an idea. After the Second World War, and with renewed confidence after the Berlin Wall fell, Western political thought placed extraordinary faith in universal individual rights, democratic procedure, and new civic identities as means of transcending older attachments of people, history, language, and place. South Africa in the 1990s became perhaps the most ambitious embodiment of that post-war consensus. The great test of whether deeply different cultural communities could flourish within a singular political order based merely upon individual rights, universal citizenship, elections, and a constructed, even abstract, civic identity. The United States and the wider West invested tremendous moral and political capital in the 1994 settlement. If the experiment produces flourishing, it vindicates its assumptions. If it produces centralization, racialization, displacement, fragmentation, and insecurity, then its failures raises questions about whether abstract institutional design can adequately mediate real differences among people, histories, language, and places, as the political science of the time thought. The second American interest is South Africa as a place. First, geography. South Africa occupies a consequential position between the Atlantic and Indian Ocean systems, astride the Cape routes and near the increasingly coveted Antarctic. Second, resources. It possesses strategic mineral reserves important to American industrial, technological, and military capacity. Those minerals may exist elsewhere, but rival dominance over South African resources and supply chains would not serve American interests. Third, there is regional order. South Africa remains an economic and institutional anchor in South Africa, and an important destination for migration within the continent. It's maybe the most important migration story in the world has never heard of. Severe decline would weaken neighboring economies, alter migration incentives across regional populations, totaling hundreds, potentially hundreds of millions of populations totaling that, and add extensive pressure to an already stressed Europe and the wider Western alliance system. Fourth, there is influence. State failure creates no neutral vacuum. It creates a space into which organized competitors, criminal networks, and adversarial powers move. Western businesses, as in the American case, generally prefer dependable contracts and infrastructure. Some competitors, however, are more willing to operate through disorder, patronage, and weak institutions. And once embedded, their influence will be far more expensive to displace than it would have been to prevent. South Africa also contains something that cannot simply be recreated after it is lost.
a remarkable centuries-old Western population and institutional inheritance. That inheritance consists not only of people, but of accumulated skills, capital, associations, commercial relationships, and institutional memory. Its networks extend beyond Western communities themselves, connecting international capital and expertise with a wider field of African businesses, employees, and institutions. If Western groups and adjacent communities were to be displaced over the coming decades, Washington cannot assume that diplomacy or investment can later reproduce so deep a presence. Across the subcontinent, this process has already occurred, for example, in Zimbabwe, and the story is the same in several other African countries. Zimbabwe was once home to 300,000 Western inhabitants. Maybe 10% of those remain today. That is catastrophic displacement. And importantly, that wiping out of a population did not occur because of a genocide in the way that phenomenon is thought to look, and therefore shows the potent erasing consequences when a people's cultural and economic basis is systematically attacked and undermined through policies of displacement. State policy, insecurity, capital destruction, and altered incentives were sufficient to produce an exodus of communities carrying essential skills and institutional networks woven through their wider societies and the other groups in that country. Such networks take generations to establish. In South Africa, these networks have developed over the course of what will next year be 375 years. They can be lost far more quickly. South Africa, therefore, matters to America both as an idea and as a place. How then could America act? The answer depends upon an accurate assessment of South Africa's trajectory and an appreciation of the extent of South Africa's ongoing reconstitution. Ongoing reconstitution. South Africa may not someday depart from the 1994 order. It has already departed from it. And quite emphatically so. We are now as far in time from 1994 as 1994 was from the inauguration of the Republic of South Africa in 1961. As Professor Koos Malan has argued, the written constitution has barely changed. Yet how South Africa is actually constituted, its people, economy, state capacity, institutions, expectations, technologies, and global context is markedly different from three decades ago. The past is a different country. Moreover, even on its own, the written constitution's practical interpretation has changed profoundly as well. By reconstitution, I mean the gradual, almost imperceptible, relocation of effective authority and responsibility towards institutions that possess the capacity to sustain order. Ideally, and often for good, but concerningly, and also often in service of raw, criminal, and corrupt power. Competence and social power are already dispersing away from the institutions originally intended to house them. The strategic question is not whether South Africa will be reconstituted. It is how its ongoing reconstitution will proceed. Washington faces three broad strategic postures. The first is accommodation. Accept. Resign to a disorderly reconstitution. And deal transactionally with the national government. The second is restoration. Attempt to recover the intended promise of the 1994 settlement. The third is constructive reconstitution. preserve the best of 1994 while strengthening the centers of order capable of carrying South Africa into a more plural and resilient future. Each posture has its proponents in Washington. Which one or which combination prevails may still be influenced. Under accommodation, Washington may conclude that changing South Africa's trajectory is neither feasible nor worth the effort. That conclusion could draw on American experience elsewhere in Africa, where expropriation, indigenization, capital consumption, corruption, and state failure proved extremely difficult to reverse. It might be undesirable and it might be wrong, but it wouldn't necessarily be irrational. America would then work transactionally with the recognized central government to secure strategic minerals, access, and other interests, while accepting the displacement of U.S.-friendly groups and institutions and the emergence of a less Western and more dysfunctional South Africa. Accommodation may preserve selected American interest in the short term, yet it concedes South Africa's institutional future. It concedes it. Under restoration, Washington could seek to recover the promise of 1994. Constitutional restraint, legal equality, non-racialism, and a liberal democratic settlement. A serious restoration strategy could employ targeted diplomatic pressure, conditional market access, financial measures, and support for constitutional institutions. But the difficulty is deeper than a government that has merely malfunctioned. The demographic, economic, institutional, and geopolitical conditions from which 1994 emerged no longer exist. Restoring the written constitution, or merely repeating the aspirations of the early 1990s, would not restore the social constitution that once sustained them. Undifferentiated sanctions, general tariffs, or financial restrictions would create an additional problem. They would weaken many businesses, municipalities, provinces, and other institutions that America should want actually to preserve and strengthen. And today's national government is both less capable of imposing a national settlement and less receptive to American influence. South Africa's predicament today is not a simple glitch. It's not a case of, have you tried switching it on and off again? The third posture begins with a more realistic assessment. 1994 cannot simply be restored. But its best elements may yet be carried into a more plural and a more resilient order. An orderly reconstitution would preserve peaceful political competition, constitutional restraint, and cooperation across communities. It would relinquish the assumption that one central political settlement must mediate every potential difference and carry every essential and social function. It would be characterized by strong and varied centers of power able to counter and even nullify race-restrictive policies and other policies targeted at Western communities and that ultimately harm all others. It would relocate practical responsibility toward institutions capable of sustaining order, economic participation, competence, and peaceful cooperation, whether those institutions are found within the state or outside of it. America need not design the final arrangement. It could instead alter the environment in which that arrangement develops by strengthening constructive institutions and changing the relative incentives confronting the destructive ones. The latter approach of constructive reconstitution would see Washington cease treating South Africa as one indivisible policy object. It would instead distinguish among provinces, municipalities, cities, businesses, cultural bodies, religious institutions, civil organizations, and parts of government according to their conduct. Sakalicha proposes to call this constructive differentiation. Constructive differentiation means dealing with South Africa's actual centers of powers according to what they do, rather than treating the country as a single, undifferentiated unit. Its criteria would be public, based on demonstrated behavior and non-racial. It would be about freedom of association, respect for property and contract, clean procurement, respect for, well, institutional competence, and peaceful and reciprocal international conduct. The precise test would differ depending on the institution, but the principle is constant. Constructive actors should be treated as partners and conduits for normalized mutually beneficial relationships. Where it serves American interests, they may receive greater access, cooperation, and support. On the other hand, actors engaged in corruption, racial exclusion, institutional destruction, or strategic hostility would not be sheltered merely because they operate in the same country. If Washington intends to avoid accommodation and seeks restoration or constructive reconstitution, either of those, instead, realism dictates that differentiation is necessary. And under the third posture of constructive, reconstitution, this constructive differentiation becomes the important organizing doctrine. To those familiar with, I'll finish up. To those familiar with U.S.-South Africa relations before 1994, the phrase has a partial namesake. In 1980, Chester Crocker advanced constructive engagement, which later informed the Reagan administration's approach. It made sense in a country with one overwhelming decisive center of power. Our assessment is that policy should follow that changed distribution of power that has emerged today. The constructive engagement with a single decisive center should move away from that to constructive differentiation among multiple centers of varying competence and reciprocity. In the interest of time, because I see Irakli is moving here, I will avoid giving you two extensive examples. I'll just say that the principle here would be that the United States could identify and design an approach to trade and other measures towards South African institutions that allow for differentiation on non-racial basis, a modern Sullivan principles, if you will, in which businesses and provinces and municipalities could sign up to and signal institutional defection with statements of non-racial conduct and minimum adherence to harmful and race-restrictive policies. The most powerful of these measures will be those America can institute through its own choices about access and cooperation without depending upon Pretoria's permission or competence. It's not regime change, it's not constitutional authorship, it's about changing the incentive structure. Some of you may have noticed Let's wrap it up. Okay. Some of you may have noticed that this is actually state-proofing at the level of foreign policy. And this is what I'm suggesting, ladies and gentlemen, that as from inside South Africa, we can follow a policy of state-proofing through our own initiative. It will be expensive, but that is a way toward restoring order and prosperity and flourishing in this country without permission. So the United States and other foreign actors could do the same. It's about differentiating and internal loci of control in South Africa instead of thinking about everything as one single whole. That is realist optimism.
This BizNews production is brought to you by Brenthurst Wealth, building wealth and protecting legacy since 2004. Invest better with Brenthurst.